Welcome back everyone to the channel. Tonight's terrifying video, I am bringing you three horrifying Reddit stories. Good luck going to sleep tonight, and let's get spooky. The dreary October day passed by slowly. Dark clouds issuing endless torrents of rain that blew sideways in ferocious waves. I looked out the office sign. Another day of life wasted working in a job I hated. I felt the rest of my life would be an endless procession of days like this. Wasted in a dreary office drinking watery cheap coffee and making small talk with people who wouldn't care if I dropped dead right in front of them. When 5 o'clock came, I saved my work on my computer and ran out the building. I was instantly soaked as the darkening clouds continued their onslaught. Lightning began to flash nearby, and a few seconds after, thunder followed, shaking the ground. Swearing, I ran to my car, fumbling with the keys to get it unlocked. By the time I sat down in the driver's seat, every article of clothing I had on was soaking wet. I turned on the heat and threw my briefcase on the passenger seat, pulling out the parking lot and merging onto the highway. Ahead, I saw flashing lights and got stuck in a traffic jam for the next 20 minutes, barely moving as a LifeStar helicopter landed not far away. As I inched along, I saw the billboard on my right. "We buy souls," it exclaimed in large, fiery letters. Souls, souls, souls. Whether new, slightly used, or heavily damaged, we are interested. Call 666-213-SOUL right now. I gaped at it in astonishment. Then quickly took the number down in my cell phone. I thought for sure that it must be some sort of bizarre prank. Finally, the traffic began to move forwards again as a lane opened up, and in another 20 minutes, I was home. My house was a small cookie-cutter replica of every other suburban house on the street, with a small lawn and an attached one-car garage. I pulled into it, grateful I wouldn't have to go back outside into the downpour, then grabbed my suitcase to go into my empty, lonely home. I made a sad dinner of instant noodles and beef jerky with Gatorade, looking at my phone for a long moment. Finally, I picked it up and dialed the number. After a single ring, a cheerful voice answered. "This is Ace Souls Incorporated. May I ask who's calling?" And so started a bizarre string of events that would ultimately end in total catastrophe. The office building they directed me to was in a rundown industrial area, a place filled with the homeless and drug addicts. It used to be one of the hubs for industry in the city, a place where countless people worked. But now most of the factory and warehouse buildings lay empty, slowly growing more and more dilapidated as the years progressed. I pulled up on a street filled with used needles and crack pipes. Seeing a homeless man with no legs sleeping next to an empty bottle of vodka on the sidewalk. He had a ripped sign with the words, "Homeless veteran, please help," scrawled in barely legible permanent marker on the front. I dropped a few spare quarters into the empty coffee cup next to the sign and walked past. A sign pointing down a dark, suspicious-looking alleyway with bright neon letters saying, "Ace Souls Inc." I followed it past the rancid dumpsters to a door on the side of an abandoned-looking factory building. I saw a bright red glowing button next to the door and a black camera above it. I pressed the button, holding it down for a couple seconds. A jarring mechanical noise sounded for a moment before a pleasant woman's voice came in through the speaker. Good evening, she said. Do you have an appointment? I do, I said, looking down at the notes I had put in my phone. I'm supposed to see a man named Randall Forrest. My name is Kevin McNair. After a second's pause, I added, he said to come any time before 9 p.m. I heard the murmuring on the other end of the line for a few moments, and then the door opened with a loud buzz. I looked down the alleyway, seeing a silhouette of a man standing there, just staring at me. His eyes seemed to glow black, shimmering in the shadows, but I couldn't make out any other features on his face. I wondered if it was just the trick of a light. I quickly walked through the door, making sure it locked behind me. Then I shuddered. Despite being in a rundown area of the city, the interior of the business actually looked pretty nice. Freshly painted white walls gleamed under bright fluorescent lights. Posters lined both sides of the hallway, most of them advertising for the business. One had a man with gleaming eyes and a huge smile holding a stack of bills, with the writing exclaimed, "Don't get cheated. We beat all other offers." A pretty blonde receptionist sat at the front desk. She gave me a polite smile as I walked into the reception hall, showing bleached white teeth between her dark red lipstick. "Ah, Mr. McNair," she said. "Mr. Forrest is excited to see you. His office is the last one on the left." She pointed down the hall. Thanking her, I walked past, seeing the rest of the bizarre posters. One had a child looking dreamily in the distance as soldiers marched past in the background with the caption, "I always wanted to be a great leader. Ace Souls made it a reality." I walked into the office with a sense of rising trepidation. Part of me wanted to simply turn around and walk out, saying I had changed my mind. I could run back to the car and peel out of this slum and forget I ever saw that bizarre billboard. But my feet kept onwards towards Mr. Forrest's office, as if on their own accord. The hallway seemed extremely long. Finally, I made it to the last office. I saw the door stood open, and a man sat there, expectant, staring at me with curiosity. He looked extremely pale, as if he had never been outside a day in his life. His eyes were dark, contrasting heavily with the deathly white shade of his skin. He had a shaved head and an expensive suit on. As I walked in, I could smell the French cologne emanating from him. "Ah, Mr. McNair," he said, rising from his chair and giving me a crooked grin. He extended his hand. I walked over to the desk and grabbed it, shaking it. I felt like I'd grabbed the hand of a corpse. A freezing, deathly cold seemed to radiate from his body, making me shiver. I shuddered as an icy chill passed down my back. "It is great to finally meet you face to face," I nodded. "Thanks for meeting me at such a late hour," I said. "With work and everything, it's hard to make time sometimes." He nodded slowly in understanding, motioning for me to sit in the chair across the desk. I did, and we both sat down. "So tell me a little about yourself," he said. "I like to understand our clients as best as possible in order to ensure that we give them the best experience possible." "Well, I'm 32, working at a dead-end office job with no friends and no girlfriend. I don't know how it got like this. I used to have lots of friends when I was younger." He nodded sympathetically. "It's like over time, more and more people just moved away or started families, and I fell further and further behind until I was left alone. I don't know. It seems to be the way life goes. I always wanted to be a writer, and I thought maybe one day I would be rich and famous. Though really, I don't care about either of those. I just want to be mildly successful. As more and more time passes, however, I have come to realize that I'm probably just going to die as a faceless nobody, working my whole life without ever achieving any degree of happiness. I felt embarrassed to reveal so much about myself and quickly averted my face, turning away from the dark, staring eyes of Mr. Forrest. I felt as if I was dissolving in those strange eyes, as if they were an inky black ocean and I was just a piece of driftwood, endlessly getting thrown by the currents this way and that. For a moment, the blackness seemed to expand and take over the whites, and the pale skins seemed to grow even lighter, like the deadly pale sheen of an albino. But I blinked my eyes and found myself just sitting across the desk from a fairly normal-looking pale man in a suit. "Ah, yes, Mr. McNair," he said. "That is a story I've heard many times. I think we could help you, though. It's what we do here, after all." He pulled out a piece of jet black paper from inside his desk. It shone like polished jet, glimmering under the bright office lights. I'd never seen anything quite like it. Taking a quill pen from the corner of his desk, he dipped it in an inkwell and began writing. I saw the blood-red ink forming into letters as his neat copper plate handwriting began to fill the page. After a few minutes of uncomfortable silence, he looked up, smiling. He held it out to me. "This is a standard contract," he said. "If you agree, just sign at the bottom." I looked at the piece of black paper, reading the official-looking title on top and Forrest writing below. "The Pack of Worms," the title read. "I, Kevin McNair, do agree on October 20th, 2023, to sell my soul to Ace Souls Incorporated under the agency of Chairman Randall Forrest, co-owner of said enterprise. In exchange, I wish to receive a sum of $1 million and a publishing contract for a novel. Payment will be taken when Ace Souls Incorporated decides it is appropriate. With free will and a stable mind, I do hereby sign this agreement. Upon signature, this agreement will be considered legally binding and may not be rescinded or changed in any way." I read the short contract, one eyebrow raised, feeling like I was on some sort of prank show. I expected to see cameras coming out of the corridors at any moment with laughing people asking, "Did you really think that was real?" But nothing of the sort happened. Mr. Forrest just continued to stare at me as I looked the black paper up and down. Sighing heavily, I took the quill pen and signed it. A week later, I was in the Bahamas, finishing up some short stories and editing the first chapters of my novel. The sweet-smelling tropical air blew through the open windows of the cabin I rented. I looked outside, seeing palm trees shaking on the beach from the strong breeze, the waves coming in endless torrents, crashing on the white sands under the starlight. I saw something coming up from the surf, silhouettes breaking through the dark waves. Blinking quickly, I got closer to the window. Three pale creatures came up out of the water. Their movements were jerky and unnatural. They had twisted, broken legs and swollen black and purple torsos. Their mouths chattered constantly, their lipless jaws opening and closing. With stick-like, emaciated arms and crooked, vampiric fingers, their swollen, naked bodies looked like something dredged up from the oceans of hell. Their eyes were pure black, like the eyes I thought I had glimpsed in Mr. Forrest's when I sat in his office. They looked protuberant, bursting from their heads like giant obsidian balls, lidless and glistening with predatory intelligence. They saw me staring at them through the window. I immediately ducked down, thinking fast. I heard soft, pattering footsteps nearby. Raising quickly, I raised myself to just a fraction of an inch above the windowsill, hoping they wouldn't see me. The way they walked was inhuman. They seemed to dance on their thin, broken legs, a jig that brought them to the right and back to the left in rapid, tapping movements. Their teeth seemed to chatter in time with the way they walked. I rose and began to run towards the front door, deciding to escape. I flung it open wide, and then I saw Mr. Forrest standing there. My heart stopped in my chest for a moment, all hope seeming to drain from my body. "Ah, Mr. McClare," he said, grinning widely at me, his skin bloodless and white, his eyes pure black and shining. "I think the time has come for your payment." Within seconds, the creatures came into sight behind him. I backed slowly into the cabin, dread filling my body. "It won't hurt much," he said, crossing the threshold. The creatures came in behind him. They smelled like wet, rotting corpses, an odor like sickness and infection emanating from their unnatural bodies. Their teeth chattering endlessly, a staccato repetition that pierced the silence inside the cabin. But I hadn't been idle while I waited. As soon as I had gotten to the Bahamas, I had gone to the rundown slums and asked around until I found a gun for sale. It was just a small .22 semi-automatic pistol, and I had greatly overpaid for it, but now I found that price small and meaningless. Staggering back towards the kitchen table, I grabbed it off the top and turned, firing at the creatures as they came closer. I hit the first in the chest. Its skin, stretched thin and rotting and filled with rancid gases, exploded, showering the floor with black worms that slid out of the wound. They looked like a den of poisonous snakes, writhing as they moved in different directions, entangling and slithering. The worms in the wound looked the same, as they came together, stitching the hole in the creature's chest closed again. Mr. Forrest laughed. "Oh, come on, Mr. McNair," he said in a genuine tone. "You didn't think it'd be that easy to get out of this now, did you?" After they forced me down on the table, the creatures began to kneel over me, spewing black worms into my mouth. I tried to keep them closed, but Mr. Ferris came over and held my jaw open with superhuman strength. The first of the worms slid down, choking me, the odor of salt, rotting meat, and pus filling my mouth in a disgusting explosion of flavors. I could feel them wiggling and pushing against my esophagus. I gagged, trying to throw them up, but more came, and then more, and soon I was lost in my inner screams and an unexplainable horror. I don't know how long I laid there, but it seemed eternal. I woke the next morning, still laying on the table. Blood streamed from my mouth. I saw the bright tropical sun shining in through the open window, and I rose. All the joy seemed to have gone out of this world. I felt I'd lost something essential. And at that moment, I began to weep, wishing I could go back and change it. The police car turned on its sirens behind me. I looked down the dark forest road, seeing nobody. At 2 a.m. in this backwoods town, everyone had already gone to bed. Or was it even 2? My head felt fuzzy, and I couldn't remember how I had gotten there. I just remember driving down an endless black road, and before that, I rolled down the window. The police car stayed far behind me. I saw both police officers get out and crouch behind their open doors while they pointed black shotguns at my car. "Driver," the cop on the passenger side called. "Roll down your window and turn off your car. Do it now." I already had the key turned to the accessory position rather than in ignition mode. But I quickly rolled down the driver's window and plucked the keys out. My heart hammered in my chest, and my mouth felt like sandpaper. I looked around worriedly, wondering what had caused all this. I hadn't killed or robbed anyone that I could remember, yet they acted like they had just caught Ted Bundy himself in a VW bug with a kit containing a ski mask, handcuffs, a fake cast, and a box of amyl nitrates. "Driver," the police droned. "Throw your keys out the window. Do it now." I threw the keys out the window. "Driver, open the door and put your hands out of the car. Get out slowly. Do it now." Very slowly, I moved out of the car with my hands up. "Now, driver, keep your hands in the air. Do not make any sudden movements. Do not turn around. Do not move your hands anywhere near your body. I want you to walk backwards towards the sound of my voice. Do it now." I walked backwards down the dark side of the road, nearly tripping on stones and branches. I was terrified that if I fell, I would be filled with more lead than Flint, Michigan's water supply. At this point, I had so many guns pointed at me that I felt like John Dillinger leaving a movie theater. Not to make light of the situation at the time, I seriously thought I was going to die. "Get on your knees and keep your hands in the air. Do it now." I slowly got to the ground, kneeling. A few moments later, I felt my arms wrenched behind my back, painfully pulling at my shoulder. I swore in pain. "Watch out, that frickin' hurts," I cried. One of the cops roughly dragged me up my cuffed wrists, spinning me around to face him. He leaned close to me, whispering in my ear. I could smell the stale coffee on his breath. "You frickin' sicko. You are a real piece of garbage, you know that? What you did makes me want to throw up. The guys in prison hate people like you. I'll be glad to hear that you're dead too, soon enough. You remember what happened to Jeffrey Dahmer?" He pushed me hard against the hood of the police car. Then they brought me down to the station. On the way there, I thought back on how I got here, only catching glimpses of the truth. I waited in a small concrete room, looking at the whitewashed brick walls, wondering what came next. A minute later, two detectives walked into the room. A man in the lead looked like a human walrus. He had small, watery eyes, a large, bristling mustache over his thin lips, and a massive barrel chest with a gut that pushed against the buttons of his police shirt. The buttons looked like they would fly off at any moment from tension, yet miraculously, they stayed put. "Hey, Gabriel," the large man said, pulling a chair from the table and sitting down with a heaving sigh. "My name is Detective Carmichael. This is Detective Minervini." He gestured to the other police officer sitting next to him, a thin, serious man with dark Italian features. "And we're here to listen. That's all we're doing. We just want to hear what you have to say." I nodded. After they read my Miranda rights, they spent the next few minutes asking me basic information, like my address, my phone number, when I moved to my current location, and how many cars I had, where I worked, and so on. I'm not a stupid man. I know how such things work. The detectives try to get a baseline reading on how someone asking them various tribal details about their lives before jumping into the crime. They notice their body language, expressions, tone, and speech patterns while telling the truth. Sometimes they would bring in a lie detector test, but what they don't tell subjects is that lie detector tests are inadmissible in court and scientifically useless. There have never been any evidence showing a polygraph can reliably determine truth from lies. Countless psychopaths have passed the polygraph and proven their innocence, including the Green River Killer. But this is irrelevant, because the real purpose of the polygraph is to allow detectives to watch the subject's body language during questioning and compare it to their baseline response. Some people get so freaked out by the idea of a polygraph that they just begin mixing up stories and sweating, not realizing that their own body language betrays them more than the actual electrical impulses on the chart. In a sense, the polygraph is more psychological warfare than a machine, a way to fake people out before pressuring them into confessions. Gabriel? Detective Minervini asked. You still with us? I looked up suddenly, realizing I had gotten lost in my thoughts and stopped listening to the conversation. Sorry, what? I asked. Where were you today? Give us a timeline of events from the moment you woke up, he said. Today? I said contemplatively, reflecting back on the worst day of my life. I woke up groggy from not getting enough sleep. I had worked late into the previous night on a novel I was hoping to publish, vaping constantly and chugging cup after cup of coffee. Eventually, around 3 a.m., I gave up on editing and decided to go to bed. I looked at the clock, noticing it was only 8 a.m. I got up, showering and making breakfast, trying to figure out what to do for the day. I lost my job a couple of months earlier, and things had started getting desperate. I had maybe $500 in my bank account, which was all the money I had in the world to pay the rent, buy food and gas and cover all my bills. I knew I was screwed. Over the last few weeks, I had put in hundreds of job applications. A lot of them were crap, minimum wage or temp jobs that I would only take as a last resort. My phone started ringing, and I looked down at the screen, seeing an unfamiliar number. A surge of hope ran through me. Hello? I said. Static and chaos carried through the line. I pulled the phone away from my ear. After a couple of seconds, a voice started coming through. Mr. Gardini? A female voice said. This is him, I said. Who's calling? Yes, hi, my name is Becky Mayer. I'm the head of human relations at Eyes Unlimited. We do surveillance and cameras and security, among other things. I was calling about a potential opening in our company. I don't remember ever applying to any company by that name, I said, confused. How did you get this number? Oh, you were referred to us, she said cryptically. Or actually, maybe we found you online. Perhaps you put your resume on a job posting website. Anyways, would you be able to come in for an interview sometime today? I asked about pay and benefits, and when she told me the job paid $25 an hour, I said I'd come down immediately. She gave me the address. I wrote it down on my phone and got changed into some nice clothing before heading out. I drove towards the capital, about 15 minutes away. My GPS started taking me into rougher and rougher neighborhoods. Used needles littered the streets and drug dealers and hoods stood at every corner, watching cars that passed with hawk's eyes. You have arrived, the female robotic voice said as I finally pulled into an abandoned slum filled with empty factory and apartment buildings. I looked around nervously. You've got to be kidding me, I said. Who would want to have a business located here? But I assumed the rent must be extremely cheap, at least. I looked around, seeing a sign for Eyes Unlimited in grimy white letters over a black background. All around it, the sign had hundreds of eyes painted in reptilian, human, avian, insectoid, bovine, and some others that I didn't think were from this world. Weird, I muttered. I looked around, realizing there were no cars on the street. A homeless man a half block away was stumbling around, yelling at invisible enemies. His mind was clearly gone over the brink. Dressed in tattered rags, he looked like a concentration camp inmate, emaciated, his legs and arms like twigs, his eyes sunken like the water at the bottom of a deep well. I quickly turned away, walking down the alley that led to the front entrance for the business. I saw a door painted like fresh gold, a heavy contrast to the layers of filth and grime that covered all the walls and windows of their abandoned buildings in the area. It had a buzzer at the front, a red button that flashed on with an inner light when I pushed it. A static rose came through the speaker, and then a woman's voice came over the intercom. "Who is this?" she asked. I gave her my name, and the door immediately unlocked with a buzzing sound. I opened it and found an empty half-lit hallway lined with statues and paintings. Some of them were truly bizarre, half-human abominations with reptilian eyes and skin, or ghostly creatures with stretched-out, screaming mouths. I stopped to examine one when a voice rang out directly behind me, making me jump. "Do you like them?" a short, plump woman with blonde hair asked. "They have cameras in them, each and every one. No one would ever see them." "Who would ever suspect a camera in a work of art such as this, right?" "A work of art?" I thought to myself sarcastically, repressing a laugh. "I'm Becky," the woman said, walking up to me and stretching out her hand. She looked totally nondescript, a typical faceless office worker in an endless company. She had a thin white gold necklace with a strange symbol hanging from the bottom. It looked like the Grim Reaper's scythe with a slashing diagonal line through it. The white metal of the pendant sparkled over her red blouse, and a sense of trepidation rose inside me. Something about that symbol. "Hi, I'm happy to finally meet you. I really like these statues with cameras you have here," I lied. She smiled, absolutely beaming with pride. "Yes, thank you. This is a lifetime's work. Each piece is personally designed by an artist. Some are specially ordered by wealthier customers who don't want cameras all over their property, so they have them hidden within the statues," she said. "Other times, we even have very special works go up on auction, especially the ones made by Mr. Bauer." "Mr. Bauer?" I asked. "Yes, the person you're going to see right now," she said, turning and opening the door. In the next room, I saw a reception's desk with chairs for waiting customers or visitors. Potted plants were placed randomly throughout. And against the walls and hanging from the ceiling, I saw more of those works of art. One had a bloody knight carrying his own smile, skeletal head in his armpit, the eyes dripping from their sockets. Personally, I was not impressed. But I know there's a market for everything. A niche company selling professionally made artist statues with hidden cameras and surveillance equipment inside might appeal only to a small audience, but with enough rich customers, why couldn't they have a successful business? Becky continued to talk about the office and the artists as she led me down a long, thin hallway. Fluorescent lights flickered overhead as we walked over a drab, dry carpet the color of razor wire. As we got to the door, I realized I hadn't asked her the most fundamental question of all. "So, what do you guys actually do here?" I asked. "Is this a manufacturing place?" She shook her head. No. The artists have their own studios and spaces to work. This is just an office building," she said. "We just store them here and deliver them from here. The open position I called you about involves transporting certain works of art to customers all over the region. It doesn't require a CDL or anything, don't worry. But Mr. Bauer will tell you more." She turned, waving. "Okay, good luck." I felt I had a much better grasp of the situation now. This business was really just a Halloween store for rich people, and the job itself was just a delivery man. I looked up at the wooden door, seeing the name Dennis Bauer engraved in the door. I knocked.
"Come in!"
a high, feminine voice called, dragging the words out. I opened it, walking inside. An extremely fat man sat behind the desk. He had all the hair on his body shaved off. His eyes looked like little pig's eyes. In fact, he gave off a porcine presence as a whole. The pink color of his skin and the way the fat bulged at the back of his neck made him look like he was some kind of horrible half-human, half-pig hybrid. His chair groaned as he shifted his massive bulk. The buttons on his white shirt looked as if they might pop off at any moment. A glint of silver caught my eye. I saw the same necklace on the man that I had seen on Becky. Looking around the office, I saw more paintings and sculptures with hidden surveillance equipment. Some of them looked like creatures from the H.P. Lovecraft stories. Humanoid beings with green tentacles and large, intelligent eyes. Others looked like something from an Academy nightmare, like the painting with prancing green aliens skinning people alive and wearing their faces as masks as they laughed and danced. "You like what you see, huh?" Dennis Bauer said in a high, girlish voice, a slight lisp coming out as he spoke. "I did them all myself." "Yes, they're very, unique," I said, giving him a fake smile. "I've certainly never seen anything like it." "Well, that's the best compliment of all," he said, opening a can of Coke and chugging the whole thing in one gulp. He threw the empty can in the garbage and turned to me. "So the job's yours if you want it. I already saw your resume. You can start now. Interested?" This sudden shift caught me off guard, and I stuttered for a moment, thinking. "Oh, yeah, I mean, okay, I guess," I said. "Like, right now?" "Yes, do you have a car?" he asked. I nodded. "Good. We'll reimburse you for any miles you drive. Gas plus wear and tear on the vehicle. This is in addition to the $25 an hour and full benefits. After 3 months, you become eligible for a raise, too. Assuming your work is professional." I nodded quickly. I felt lightheaded and sweaty. "I'll work as many hours as you need," I said quickly. "I could really use the money." He smiled, nodding, showing off his small white teeth. He licked his small, greasy lips, swiveling his head and peering around the office. Finally, he found what he sought and pointed at a large sculpture on the table. It had a snarling half-human, half-dog on a marble foundation. The creature was gnawing on a human arm, still wearing its denim sleeve. Dennis Bauer said something, but I didn't understand. "What was that?" I asked. "Dog man," he said again simply. I nodded, waiting for more. "That's what it is. The guy loves dog man crap. Anyways, this is the address." He wrote something down on a piece of paper in a looming cursive script, ripping it in half and handing it to me. As he said goodbye, I grabbed the sculpture and started heading back out towards the decaying slum outside. I had about an hour's ride each day. After putting on Audible, I pulled off, seeing the homeless man down the street still screaming at imaginary enemies. It looked like a methamphetamine overdose, or possibly a psychotic break. Either way, I wasn't getting involved. Driving from the business to the address felt almost like watching a documentary on extremes of wealth in the USA. I started at slums filled with garbage and abandoned buildings, and ended up at a rich area filled with mansions and pristine dark forests. As I pulled out onto the street Dennis Bauer had written down, Angel Trace Road, I marveled at just how massive and ornate some of these houses were. Most towered at least 4 or 5 stories overhead, with swimming pools and mazes and statues in the yards. I saw a couple riding their own personal horses down the side of the road, and I could almost smell the money pouring off them. Every house also had a gate and an intercom, and most also had security guards at the front. I went slow, seeing the security guards watching my car with squinted, suspicious eyes. Finally, I pulled up at 77 Angel Trace Road. I saw a castle looming overhead with turrets that reached 10 or 11 stories high. A security guard immediately got out of the booth and knocked on my window. I rolled it down and told him my name and business. He kept his hand near his holstered pistol at his side the entire time. Sighing, he went back into the guardhouse and, a moment later, the gate started rolling slowly to the side. I got out of my car holding the heavy statue under one arm. I walked up the wide marble steps towards the front door. I was about to knock when I saw a note in spiky, nearly illegible handwriting taped to the mahogany door. I pulled it off, squinting. "Please come in. We will be with you in a moment." I read it, an eerie feeling coming over me. I looked back down at the private road, seeing the security guard staring at me intently through the glass window in his booth. I turned and opened the door, deciding I would just go inside and wait like the note said. A rancid smell hit me as I entered the castle. It smelled like a rodent had died in the vents and began to decompose. I wondered how people with so much money could live with that odor, even for a single day. I tried to breathe through my mouth, wondering how long this would take. I walked around the entrance hall, admiring the massive Persian carpets covering the floor and the statues and paintings covering the walls. I was staring at an old painting of sailors on a heaving ship at sea when I heard a creaking floorboard behind me. I jumped. "Oh, you scared me," I said, turning and then freezing in my tracks. Three people stood there, wearing black jumpsuits and medieval plague doctor masks. All of them had long, gleaming knives in their gloved hands. Silver pendants with grim reapers with a slashing diagonal line hung from each of their necks. For a long moment, no one said anything. I put my hands up, but they made no move towards me. "You can have my wallet or whatever you want," I said. "Just take it." I took my wallet out with barely $10 in the fold and threw it towards them. They didn't react, still standing like mannequins, their eerie masks giving them the look of a psychotic, nightmarish bird. I tried to think fast. They blocked the front entrance, but there had to be countless doors on a place this size. I needed to get out and needed to get help from the security guard. The three masked figures slowly angled their heads to the right in unison, as if I had said something interesting. I looked around, seeing a heavy wooden chair tucked at a desk a couple of feet behind me. With a rush of adrenaline, I grabbed the chair and threw it at them. Without looking back, I sprinted away, going deeper into the house, hoping to find another exit on the sides or back before they caught up with me. I could only imagine the sensation of the knives going in, slicing through the skin as effortlessly as a diver through the water's surface. I ran through a pair of swinging doors into a huge, dirty kitchen with multiple ovens and countless counters and sinks. As I took in the scene, I realized the kitchen was worse than just dirty. It had evidence of atrocities and cannibalism on every surface and utensil. A human head stared at me from the counter, its eyes half closed. The tip of its tongue stuck out through blue, stiff lips. Worst of all, someone had cut the top of the skull off, and now the head had no brain. On frying pans with coagulated grease and swarms of houseflies, I saw human eyeballs, tongues, kidneys, and other organs, some of them cooked, some not. Dishes with bones and half-eaten cooked limbs littered other counters. I saw mice and rats scurrying away as I sprinted past, interrupting their meal in this den of nightmares. Someone stepped out from behind a large steel fridge. I ran straight into them, catching a glimpse of a black jumpsuit and a gloved leather hand as I fell. They stumbled before quickly righting themselves. They jumped on top of me, and I saw the flash of a syringe as it stabbed into my neck. I fought, kicking and punching, but waves of nausea and weakening began to run through my body, and my vision started turning black, and soon I was no more. I came to for a few moments, seeing double and triple images blurring across my vision. I heard voices, as if from far away. I saw the night sky outside through the window, the moonlight streaming down over the trees. "So this is the new one?" someone said in a low robotic monotone. "Yeah, another lamb," someone responded. "We'll take some of his hair and make sure his fingerprints are on the scene. The ketamine should cause memory problems. He probably won't even know how he got here when the cops finally catch up with him. We might as well frame him for this place, too," someone else said. The voices laughed. "Sure, why not? We've got to find another place soon anyway." I remember going in and out of sleep, having strange hallucinations and visions. Time and place seemed liquid. For a while, I thought the abductors were aliens, and that their plague doctor masks were the real skin on their horrible faces. As I sobered up a little, they finally put me in the driver's seat of my car on an isolated side street. I still didn't know where I was or what had happened. I could barely remember my name. I saw night had come. They left. After a while, I turned on my car and started driving. Then I saw flashing lights behind me, and suddenly, I started feeling very sober. I tried to remember how I had gotten there, but the truth kept slipping through my fingers, the memories fading away into darkness. I gave this story to my lawyer and asked him to make sure my family received it and put it online, as a way to warn others and try to get justice. Before I did so, I slouched on the metal chair as if a heavy weight had pulled me down. The lawyer continued to speak through the round vent in the plexiglass separating us as I wrote my experiences down. "Well, they checked on that building you talked about, this Eyes Unlimited. There's no sign and no business there. No one has rented that space in years," he said. "And that castle on Angel Trace Road has no security guard. In fact, that place has been empty for years. The bank foreclosed on it and no one has bought it." I groaned. "Right now you're looking at the death penalty," he said. "The public is out for blood in this case. They're preparing over 20 counts of first-degree murder. There were a lot of people killed in horrific ways, and they only found your DNA and fingerprints at the crime scenes." "But I didn't do it," I said. He shrugged. "This isn't about what you did or didn't do. Everything in life is power, and who has the will to use it?" I felt hope drain from me as I sat there, seeing the future as just a solid wall in front of me, a wall as black and empty as an endless abyss. I remember the first time I saw the man, the thing with the face like melting wax. I knew that he had many masks and many names. He had followed our family for years, and from father to son, mother to daughter, the fear and terror of the faceless man got passed down. Every time he came, he would have a different face. The first time I saw him, he looked like a withered old Asian man, leaning heavily on a wooden cane with a silver top. Our front door stood wide open, and I saw my mother and father standing there, their faces as pale as ghosts as they looked down upon the stranger. I couldn't have been older than 11 years old, but the memory is still as sharp as a butcher's knife stuck into my brain. I walked forwards from the living room, the cartoon noises still blaring loudly in the background. The man looked past them and straight at me. He squinted his eyes and grinned. "Another lamb so pretty and young," he mused.
Isn't it a shame when a child is taken so early in life? And yet God kills children every day. I heard last month a hurricane blew an entire school down and killed 100 of the little bastards in one swift go. So perhaps God will forgive me for my small sins, my taking of a few here and there to keep my appetite satisfied. Get out of here, my father snarled through gritted teeth. He clenched his fists until the knuckles turned white, looking like he would strike out at any moment. Do you know who I am? The faceless man asks in a whispering voice. Then he began chuckling. It sounded like someone trying to laugh with a slit throat, a harsh gurgling sound that raised goosebumps all up and down my body. My father slammed the door shut quickly, locking the deadbolts. I fingered the silver cross my mother had given me nervously. I always did when I was anxious. Feeling it laying there cold against my skin helped bring me back to the moment. My father turned to look at us with panic-stricken eyes. I heard a light knocking on the door behind him as the demonic laughter continued to grow louder until it became all I could hear. Then, without warning, it cut off. When I looked out the peephole on the front door, I saw the front stoop stood empty. Get my gun, my father said to my mother. She left the room, quietly sobbing as she went. Sunlight from the warm summer sky continued to stream in through the windows. What a beautiful day, I thought to myself. Such a beautiful day, and maybe my last. Then I saw a shadow cross in front of the living room window. I saw someone peeking in with wide, excited eyes. A grin like a skull spread across his leathered old face. As I watched, the face began to drip and contort as it continued to smile. It started slowly around the lips and eyes, and then it began speeding up. Within seconds, I saw the flesh running down his cheeks and chin in rivulets, dripping like flesh-colored wax. Behind the mask he wore, I caught a glimpse of something horrible before new streams of flesh rolled over it from his scalp and forehead. Then the last of the human skin dripped off, and I found myself staring into the face of hell. I could never explain the true horror of the thing lurking behind its costume of human skin. It felt like I was staring into a pus-filled wound with maggots writhing around the edges, or maybe like falling into a mass grave. Some of its body seemed flipped inside out, with the glistening muscles on the outside. But the bloody demonic face was far more disturbing. It had eyes like two smoldering cigarette burns. Its mouth was a slashed, disgusting thing. The lips looked eaten away, with ragged patches of flesh surrounding them that seemed to make the smile much more larger, reminding me of how a clown would do his makeup. I saw that grinning mouth filled with countless needle-sharp teeth above black, sore-ridden gums that writhed and shivered in its lipless mouth. Even through the window, a smell like sulfur and reeking spoiled meat filtered into the house, seeming to fill the air like a physical presence. Its body looked flipped inside out. I could see the quivering muscles on the skinless figure. It looked deathly thin, and veins ran across the outside of its face and body like thick, dark worms pulsating with each beat of the satanic heart that laid inside the thing's chest, emanating sickness and evil through every pore of its gleaming body. As it stared into my soul with its black, lidless eyes, I saw in that face of all the worst nightmares of the universe. I saw mountains of corpses festering under a hot sun. Black holes eating worlds as masses screamed. I saw mothers drowning their children in bathtubs and animals eating each other alive. I saw into eternity, and it looked so dark and empty that I fell to my knees pleading. Make it stop, make it stop, I screamed, tears streaming down my face. My father ran in with his shotgun raised, but when I looked back up, the window was empty. yet the visions continued to run through my mind like a movie. Atrocity after atrocity, and somehow, it all connected back to the faceless man. After a few seconds of utter silence, that deep, gurgling voice rang out, making us all jump. It seemed to come from nowhere and everywhere at once, reverberating throughout the room. It said something that made my father waver on his feet, a strange verse, but one I remember by heart to this day. Here is Belladonna, the Lady of the Rocks. The Lady of Situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel. And here is the one-eyed merchant, and this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see. I do not find. The Hanged Man. After that, we barricaded the doors and locked all the windows. I knew it wouldn't keep the faceless man out. He could easily just smash through a window, and perhaps he wouldn't even need to do that. Maybe he could just pass inside the house anytime he wanted, and yet, if so, why hadn't he? So it's starting again, my mother said, looking at my father with a powerful intensity in his eyes. He has come back again for a sacrifice. My father nodded slowly. What do you mean a sacrifice? I asked, my child's mind not comprehending the magnitude of the situation yet. My father hesitated. He eats the souls of people, my father said. He and my great-grandfather drew up a contract a long, long time ago, and ever since, our family has had great wealth. You're young, so you don't really understand fully yet, but not everyone lives in mansions like us. Not everyone vacations in Paris and Buenos Aires during summer vacation. Not everyone has a garage full of Porsches and Mercedes. So why don't you just tell him no? I asked in my childish way. We don't need all this money. The left side of my father's face began twitching. He stomped towards me, shouting as tears ran down his face. I don't give a crap about money, he said. The deal was drawn in blood and cursed from the first day. Do you think if I could get him to go away by giving him everything I own, I wouldn't? I would do it in a heartbeat. I'd live in a damn trailer and eat instant noodles if I had to. But there is no escape. He looked around, as if expecting to see the faceless man standing right behind him. He began looking out of the windows, seeing nothing but a bright summer's day. We need to go, my mother whispered. Now, let's just take Susan and go. He won't find us if we keep moving. He'll find us, my father said, looking defeated. Tears continued to stream down his face. He looked like a defeated man. He always does, but F it, let's go. We'll take the bastard on a run around the world. We took off from the property, and my father told me more about the deal as we flew out of town on an expensive Mercedes. I thought more than once he would crash and kill us all in a frenzy to put the distance between us and the faceless man. Once every 50 years, my father said, he comes. He has his pick of the litter, as he calls it. He takes one child from our family and, in exchange, our wealth is guaranteed for the next 50 years. Even during the Great Depression, our family didn't suffer, except, of course, the periodic abductions of children. He makes the parents watch as he takes the soul of the child into himself. I don't know what kind of foul magic it involves, but from what I've read in diaries of my grandfather, it is a very painful ritual that involves skinning the child alive and rubbing their body with special herbs. Then he makes them walk, totally skinned and bleeding to death until they collapse. And that's when he takes the soul. He sucks it out of their eyes. It looks like thin wisps of light when it finally goes out. I shook inward in horror. No one would ever allow that to happen to their kid, I said confidently. My father shook his head. You act as if we have a choice, he said. The first time he comes politely,
knocks on the door and tells the parents it's time to fulfill the contract. If they say no, then he leaves. But he always comes back. And the next time, he won't be polite, and he won't leave. He'll come into the house when we're sleeping, torture me and your mother to death, slit our throats, and then take you away. He's tireless, he doesn't age, he doesn't sleep, and as far as I know, he can't die. How could we fight against such an evil? By going to the moon? But why did Great-Grandpa make a deal like that anyways? I asked. Because at the time he had 10 children and all of them were starving. A few had dysentery and he didn't have a penny to his name at the time. He chose to sacrifice one to the faceless man to save the other 9. My father shrugged. I don't know if we can understand it. I certainly don't agree with it. I'm not sure he realized at the time that our family would suffer eternally afterwards, and that the contract could not be voided except through deaths. He laughed bitterly. We should have just left our family line die out, maybe. That would have solved the problem. What about the words at the end, Daddy? I said. What do those mean? Oh, that's just an old famous poem. My grandfather used to recite it to me before he shot himself. He loved T.S. Eliot, and he thought that poem had some relevance to our problems for some reason. He never got over the loss of his son to the faceless man, you see. Never. He used to wake up screaming in the night. He tried to drink his memories away, but in the end... My father braked suddenly, bringing the car to a full stop. I looked up, seeing forests on both sides of us. We hadn't traveled long. A hitchhiker stood at the edge of the road in grimy blue jeans and a bright tie-dye shirt. His long hair rippled around him as he stood with his thumb out. But his face had started to drip and melt. We all saw it and froze. My father reached down below his seat and pulled out the black shotgun. He ran out of the car like a madman, his eyes blazing with anger and terror.
"Get out of here!"
he cried as if to a rabid animal. Then he raised the shotgun and fired. The faceless man's tie-dye shirt burst into shreds and buckshot tore into it. The faceless man smiled, raised his hand to us in a wave and disappeared. The clothes felt limply to the grass below, now totally empty. My father shook his head grimly and turned around to come back to the car. A dark shape loomed out of the forest, holding a sharp knife. Before my father could run, he raised it to his throat and pulled. My mother screamed, getting out of the car to go help my father. But he was dead. Even as a child, I knew it. I could see the knife had practically severed his head from his body, except for the spine and the thin bit of flesh on the back. Blood poured out, flooding down his chest as he stood there for a moment uncomprehending. Then he began to fall forwards, and his head snapped back, revealing the gore, muscles, and ligaments beneath. I watched as my mother ran to his side, panic-stricken. The faceless man looked on with glee, laughing and shrieking. His black eyes blazed with an inner light as he looked towards me and grinned, showing the 100 needle-sharp teeth behind that separating sore of a mouth. My mother looked up at him, trying to grab the gun from my father's stiff hands. But the faceless man didn't even flinch. He ran forwards, his sleek, bloody body as fast as a greyhound's. He opened his mouth wide and bit at my mother's face. I saw the teeth bite into her skin, and he began to shake his head like a dog, ripping and shredding. Her face became a mask of gore, and I screamed in the car, nearly throwing up. But something inside me told me I needed to move. I wasn't a stupid kid after all. I wasn't going to die here next to some woods in the middle of nowhere. I ran out of the back seat and jumped into the driver's seat. I had never driven a car, but it was, after all, an automatic. It didn't take much intelligence to put it in drive and hit the gas pedal. Of course, I didn't really know how to drive, and I nearly hit a tree. I skidded, turning the wheel, and with 2 bumps, I accidentally ran over my mother and father.
The faceless man shrieked with laughter as I drove off down the road, crying and screaming in the car. I abandoned it a few hours later in the city. My father had brought a massive envelope of cash with him in the center console, and I counted it with awe. It was hundreds of thousands of dollars. I went on the run soon after, moving across the country and living off the money I found. It was 4 years later when I went to a carnival, bored, and decided to have my future read. I hadn't seen the faceless man in years, and I figured I had lost him. If only that were true. The old woman pulled out her tarot card deck and began flipping them over one by one.
"Ah,"
she said in a voice that seemed to deepen. "I see. Here is a man with three staves, and here the wheel, and here is the one-eyed merchant." I screamed, backing up quickly as the flesh began to drip off her face. "And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I am forbidden to see." The last of the skin dripped off. The grinning thing beneath rose from the chair. Its sleek, bloody body and black holes of eyes regarded me with glee. "Ah, see, I am forbidden to see, but I have seen it. I've seen it, and look what it's done to me. Susan, look at what it's done. Your mother and father rot in a shallow grave somewhere, pricked clean by animals. And now it's just you and me, Susan, and we're alone. The card is blank, but it doesn't have to be. Come and see what it holds." He rose into the air, his bloody skeletal feet dangling feet above the ground. "Come and see." I pulled the pistol I always carried out of the holster and began firing at point-blank range into the demonic face and black heart of the thing. People began to scream all around me at the carnival. I turned to run out of the tent, but a cold hand gripped my shoulder. "Leaving so soon?" The soft voice whispered into my ear, laughing with the sound a drowning man might make. "Ah, but we haven't finished, Susan. Worthy is a lamb, worthy is a lamb, worthy is the..." Suddenly, the hand twitched, and the silver cross my mother had given me as a small girl, and it flicked away. I felt the grip loosen as I ran without looking back. People had taken cover all over the carnival. Many had started to leave, and I saw agitated police and security trying to find out where the gunshots had come from. I immediately mixed into a large crowd and made my way towards the exit. But I constantly looked back, expecting to see a man with a melting face. Perhaps it would act like a police officer and pretend to arrest me before bringing me to some dark forest and starting that skinning process. I keep running now, but I always look over my shoulder. Because the faceless man doesn't age, and he doesn't sleep. And he never, ever stops looking.